ain't getting moved. I don't care who it is. Let's go. Give me everything you got. Play fast, play hard. Let's beat these boys tonight in their house.
It's party time. It's party time.
Dad, here we go.
Touchdown!
Welcome to the Eagle Eye in the Sky Football Podcast. I'm your host, Fran Duffy, here on PhiladelphiaEagles.com. Joining me, as he does here every week, NFL Film Senior Producer Greg Cosell. We've got a great show for you here today. We're going to obviously recap the Eagles' huge win over the Indianapolis Colts on Monday night, look ahead to the upcoming matchup against the Washington Redskins coming to town on Sunday, and talk a little on NFL Draft with my good buddy Josh Norris. So a lot of good things going on. Greg, first of all, how's it going this week? Excited to be in. Obviously, both of us recuperating from a late night.
Yes, yes, but I have to recuperate by working long hours.
Yes.
So, which I imagine you have to do the same.
Exactly right.
But I guess it could be worse than watching film.
Things could definitely be worse.
Yes.
Well, you brought up the film. What were the first things that stood out to you watching the Eagles-Colts film?
Well, I got to tell you, the defensive side of the ball on many levels stood out more to me. I thought that there were a couple of schemed runs by the Colts that were effective with the unbalanced line, and they caught them with the counter back to the weak side. The Eagles were a little bit misaligned and actually made a nice adjustment with their front in the second half. But other than that, I really thought the front seven played extremely well. I love what Bill Davis is doing with his blitz concepts, his pressure concepts, the way he's using multiple fronts, moving people around, putting Kendricks and Ryans as stand-up outside linebackers, and then putting Cole and Connor Barwin or even Graham, Cole and Graham, as inside stand-up jokers, as I call them, and they're designing blitzes, you know, basically for Trent Cole or Graham. I think they're doing some really good things. And I think the thing that really stands out to me, one of the things, and it's obviously the reason they brought him here, is the versatility of Jenkins.
Yep. No
because
question.
They played a lot of base against the Colts to their 11 personnel, their three wide receiver personnel, and I firmly believe they did that because of the versatility of Jenkins, because he can line up over slot wide receivers and match up man-to-man, and the Eagles play a lot of man-to-man. So really defensively, I was really impressed with where this defense is going, and maybe people are now saying, well, the Colts got 27 points, but obviously it's a continuing work in progress. I think this defense is looking pretty good, and they're getting to be a quicker defense. They're flying around to the ball.
You alluded to the fact, obviously, you know, the Colts did burn them a couple times early on with those unbalanced counter runs back. They did a lot of pulling of the backside guard, whether it was power, whether it was counter. They brought Hugh Thornton around. They brought Jack Muebert
yep.
going to the other side. I thought, obviously, they adjusted. They came back out in the third quarter. I thought Trent Cole kind of set the edge a little bit better than he had early on in the game. They really started to, you know, sniff out some of those inside runs. And really, the tackling got better as well. You know, I know you could say this really about any defensive performance. If you take out some of those bad penalties, you take out some of those missed tackles near the line of scrimmage, this defense performance maybe to the layman may look a lot better.
Yeah, and look, there were 15 runs by the Colts that gained 5 or more yards, and that's too many.
Yep.
But I think a lot of those came in the first half. It struck me watching the tape, and you always get a different perspective watching the tape, Fran, as you know. The game is kind of, you're in the moment. The tape, you're sort of doing it analytically. I really felt that when crunch time came in the second half, that the Colts were not running the ball. And I thought that Fletcher Cox had a really good game.
Exactly.
I thought D'Amico Ryans had a really good game. And he's another guy that allows the Eagles, I think, to be pretty versatile. There was one shot play where D'Amico Ryans did a tremendous job of hunting up the deep cross. And it was, if I'm not mistaken, it might have been a no-huddle play where they got up to the line of scrimmage in a hurry and they did play action with Luck under center. And they had Hilton going deep, and that got taken away by the safety. And they expected to hit the crosser, and D'Amico Ryans just, he read it perfectly. It's little plays like that that are so important in games. You don't really see that when you watch the game live, but then when you watch the tape, you see that.
And if I remember, if we're thinking about the same play, there was really a great job, a great scheme up front. Lots of stunting, lots of twisting with, you know, Fletcher Cox looping around. Trent Cole had great effort coming from the backside, kind of moved Andrew Luck off of his spot, and Fletcher Cox kind of got in the way there, got his arms up, deterred a throw, and it was a throw out of bounds. If we're thinking of the same
play. We are thinking of the same
play. It was a three-level stretch.
Right.
It was one of their three-level
right.
stretch plays.
And the other play that stood out to me was 3rd and 14. I think it might have been in the first half, and he ended up throwing an incompletion to Wayne like at about the five-yard line.
Yep.
Do you remember that play? Yep. Great pressure concept because they just nailed Luck right as he threw it, and I'm sure that impacted the throw being high. But that was one of the schemes I talked about. I think Trent Cole was sort of a stand-up inside joker on that play, if memory serves me correctly. But I think the defense, Bill Davis, see, you have to remember his pedigree. He was a young coach with the Blitzburg Steelers in the early 90s with Dom Capers, Dick LeBeau, that whole group, and that's where he cut his teeth in the NFL. And at heart, he's a pressure guy. And you're starting to see with the second year, and this is the way it normally works.
Yep.
Everybody wants it to happen immediately, but you know how it works. You know, there's a lot to teach. And I think you're starting to see them become more effective with their pressure schemes and the multiple use of personnel.
Yeah, and you talk about the personnel. I mean, a play that comes to mind right away is the very last third down stop that the Eagles came up with. It was third and five, game on the line, tie game. If you get a stop, you force a punt, you have a chance to go down and kick a field goal. They came out in dime personnel, which obviously they're seeing
more of
this year. And they blitzed. There was a double-A gap blitz with Nolan Carroll and D'Amico coming up the middle. And it was really a great job from Nolan Carroll and from Connor Barwin, who looped inside, really just kind of getting Luck off a spot, deterring a throw. I mean, and the throw was there. Reggie Wayne was open. It was a level
concept. So was Akeem Nicks for a first day. Yeah, Luck missed that. I mean, taking nothing away from the blitz, but Luck missed that. And he doesn't miss many, but he missed that. But, you know, that's what you're trying to get accomplished, the cumulative effect of pressure. No quarterback likes to get hit. Luck took some shots. No quarterback likes to work out of what I call a muddied pocket all game long. And so what happens is it speeds up your decision making. You might not see it as clearly. So it works. And but you're right. That said a lot to me about what the Eagles are under Bill Davis. They're a pressure in-your-face defense. That's the way they're going to play.
Yep, no question about it. And obviously the first two games bode pretty well for this unit moving forward.
I couldn't agree more. So, look, we can talk offense too, but I think the offense was very erratic and up and down. A number of big plays, and those count, so you count them. I think the defense ultimately stood out to me more.
Yeah, no question about it. Now, I want to get back to the offensive side of the ball. You had an article come out today on Yahoo talking about the quarterback position. For those who missed it, you know, I finished it actually right before we took on, you know, before we started this podcast. Really kind of focusing on Colin Kaepernick. Obviously had an up and down game against Chicago the other night. But really, what was it that you really wanted to kind of portray coming out of that piece?
Well, I think it's the larger philosophical question of the quarterback position in the NFL, because it's now become sort of gospel for people to throw out there that the quarterback position is changing. And they stop at that as if they're saying 2 and 2 is 4. And I think it's a very legitimate question, Fran, to ask, what does that really mean? And is the position changing? The reason they say that is obviously there's more quote-unquote mobile athletic quarterbacks than there have ever been. The college ranks is producing more of those guys. So that's the pool of available talent coming to the NFL for the most part.
Right.
So it becomes an easy thing to say that the position is changing. But ultimately, what does that mean? And where do we go with these quarterbacks? Because the sort of old school quarterbacks, the Mannings, the Bradys, the Brees, those kinds of players, now they're older. They're true pocket quarterbacks. They're really advanced. And this starts at a young age. It's easy to say, gee, they're 35, so they're veterans. But they were advanced at a young age because they had to learn all the subtleties and the nuances of playing quarterback from the pocket. When they felt trouble or pressure or whatever, their thought is, let me get rid of the football to someone. Their thought wasn't, let me leave the pocket.
Right.
These younger guys, the Kaepernicks, the Cam Newtons, the Russell Wilsons, their thought is to leave the pocket because they've always been arguably the best athlete on the field. Their instincts take over. So if you leave the pocket early, the question becomes, do you ever develop the subtle nuances of playing from the pocket? Now, it's a trade-off. You have to decide where you fall on that line. And the reason I wrote it about Kaepernick is he obviously came off a loss. He threw three picks. Two of them were just phenomenal defensive plays. One was where he moved out of the pocket, probably prematurely. But there were also other throws in that game. And this is often the case with the Kaepernicks, the Newtons. The phrase I use is they leave throws on the field. They don't pull the trigger on throws to open receivers that require some anticipation. Now, those are throws that pocket-style quarterbacks, like the Mannings and the Bradys. And believe me, I understand Manning and Brady. We're talking about Hall of Famers. I'm talking about style, yep, not the specific player.
I mean, it could be, you know, you could be talking about Phillip Rivers. You could be talking about Ben Roethlisberger.
Correct.
Or any of these guys.
Correct. Theoretically, I could be talking about Zach Mettenberger,
right,
a sixth-round pick. He's that style quarterback.
Yep.
Okay? So what's the trade-off? You leave some throws on the field that those kinds of quarterbacks will make. Obviously, those quarterbacks are not going to run for 20 yards. Obviously, those quarterbacks are not going to give you read option elements in your run game that stress the defense. So what do you like? What do you think works best? And then you have to live with some things. Like Kaepernick, when he threw that last interception where he rolled to his left, clearly did not see Kyle Fuller. You could tell by his body language when he released the ball, he was certain he had Vance McDonald. He knew it was a great throw to Vance McDonald, but he didn't see Fuller. So as a coach, you just have to live with those things. If you're going to encourage your quarterback to move and then he makes a random arbitrary play that turns out to be a negative, because they don't all end up positive.
Right.
Contrary to highlights that we see, they don't all end up positive. Then do you just have to live with those? My guess is you do, because what are you going to do? Are you going to tell Colin Kaepernick never leave the pocket?
Right. I mean, that's the question.
So, and there's many more parts for this, Fran, because normally what happens, and I think you have a real life exhibit A example in Michael Vick, normally what happens is those guys who are runners, they slow down a little bit as they get older. Some more than others, but the defenses don't slow down. So what happens, and maybe Jim Harbaugh or Ron Rivera is not concerned about this because they're trying to win Super Bowls now, but what happens to these guys from a longevity standpoint? Are we going to be discussing Colin Kaepernick being a great quarterback when he's 33 or 34 or 35? These are just questions. You know, you have to think about that. And I don't know how these guys are coached, by the way, which is another thing. So it's really just a philosophical discussion.
Well, and that's why, you know, I wanted to bring it up, and it just so happened that this article that
right,
came out today, I wanted to bring it up just watching the Redskins over the past couple of weeks, watching RG3 and
right,
how he's looked early, you know, obviously before his injury. He lost a step. I mean, it's pretty clear that, you know,
you could say
Houston,
he lost about two or three steps.
I mean, against Houston, he's getting chased down in the flat by Brooks Reed, plays that not only where he physically gets chased down, but plays where you could see typically old RG3, 2011 RG3, he beats him to the edge. And now he's hesitating. He thinks, you know, I might not be able to make it. And now he's pulling up.
Right.
It's a question of, okay, well, now he's got to learn how to play from the pocket.
Right. And there's a perfect example. Now, who knows what the future holds? But let's assume that he didn't get hurt. Okay. And we'll talk about Kirk Cousins, I'm
yep,
sure. But let's assume he didn't get hurt. He still has to learn how to play from the pocket because those quote unquote creative skills, they're not quite there the way they were. So what do you have to fall back on? You've now got to become a timing rhythm quarterback. You can't leave throws on the field because you don't have anything to fall back on. You can't run around anymore.
Right.
And there's a lot of people who believe that no matter how mobile quarterbacks are, that you can't make a living in the NFL making plays outside of structure. Are they great once in a while? Do we see them on the highlight shows all the time? Yes, we do. But it's very hard to make a living in the NFL making plays outside of structure.
It's funny because it's happened each of the past couple of years where some of these mobile quarterbacks, you know, a Johnny Manziel is coming out of Texas A&M, coming out in college, and you know, you go and you talk about his skill set.
Right.
And it's, hey, you know, Greg Cosell hates Johnny Manziel. He doesn't think he has a chance.
Right, which has happened, as you know.
Exactly.
I mean, believe me. And you know, all I do, see, when I evaluate quarterbacks, particularly quarterbacks coming out of college, the way I evaluate them is I do it as if there's no name on the back of the jersey. And I've been doing this a long time watching coaching tape, which doesn't make me right on every – no one is.
Right.
You know, so
no
I'm question. Not suggesting I'm right. This is the opinion – these are the opinions I've developed from 25 years of NFL films, NFL coaching tape study, and, you know, now 9 or 10 years of college tape study.
Yep.
So I have a worldview of what I believe the quarterback position is in the NFL to be played as its fullest. Now, has that been adjusted over time? Do I recognize that, you know, the read option is now a part of the league, that quarterback movement is? Of course.
Yep.
But every game I watch in the NFL, there's 3 or 4 or 6 or 8, depending on the game, throws that have to be made from the pocket. So the question is, if you don't develop those skills and you don't make those throws, what next? What happens?
And that's the question now with RG3. It's even, you know, in the short term, in those particular games, that's going to be the case. But then also the long term, is he going to be able to do that over the long term?
And I think there was a little bit of a question of that, Fran.
Yeah.
Even now, of the timing, the rhythm, the footwork. See, the footwork is so tied in to route combinations. And when you drop three steps, there's routes that are three-step routes. When you drop five steps, there's routes that are five-step depth. When you drop seven steps, everything has to tie in, and your feet have to be ready for you to throw. I can't tell you how many times I see watching tape where, and don't forget, in the NFL, we're not talking about guys being wide open.
Right.
That rarely happens, okay? So your feet have to be ready to deliver the football at that precise moment, and a lot of throws are anticipation throws. You're not throwing to a stationary guy sitting there waiting for the ball. You're throwing it to a guy who's moving. And if you wait a beat too long, defenders will get there.
Yep.
And it'll either be an incompletion or an interception.
Well, while we're talking about the quarterback position, obviously RG3 is going to be on the sideline, dislocated ankle. What have you seen from Kirk Cousins this preseason? Then also, against Jacksonville this past week.
Well, I thought watching the tape against Jacksonville, a couple of things stood out. Number one, he understands the plan. He executes the plays as called. You know, he's a guy that's always been a pocket quarterback. He's always had to learn the position that way and play the position that way. So when a play is called, he understands the route concept. He understands the timing of it. He understands where the ball should go a good part of the time in relation to the coverage. The concerns you have as he goes forward, and these are not big concerns right now because this will be the first week he's taking the first team reps. So
right. He
came in last week without having taken any first team reps. I think he left some throws on the field. I think he missed some throws being a little inaccurate. I think his footwork needs to be cleaned up. He has a tendency, and if you can just picture this for those who've played sports, he has a tendency when he gets in the pocket and gets ready to throw to take his back foot and actually take a step back before he throws. So what that does is it widens his base. And if you've played sports, you know that when your feet get wider than your shoulders, it's really hard to generate leverage or power, and that's why at times he struggles to really drive the ball and doesn't have the arm strength that you would like to see. And again, now it gets down to a discussion of arm strength and its value, but there are some throws that require arm strength. So the question is, will he make those throws? But I think he's got a chance to be the kind of quarterback that if he's got complementary pieces and a good team, he could be a quality NFL starter.
And there are some complimentary pieces there.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got, obviously, Pierre Garçon, DeSean Jackson, who may not play this
right.
week, Andre Roberts.
Jordan Reed, who missed last week.
Niles Paul is another athletic guy
yeah.
who can move and get down the scene.
He was a wide receiver in Nebraska.
Exactly right. Logan Paulson has seen some reps. Obviously, they use Alfred Morris, Roy Helu in the passing game. Darryl Young caught a vertical pass for a touchdown, which was really a blown coverage by Dwayne Gratz there. But, obviously, they get a lot of guys involved. And really just watching their offense, I was surprised against Houston. And obviously, it had a lot to do with protection. J.J. Watt was
– oh, boy.
Well, let me tell these guys a story. So last week, we were getting ready from the podcast, and I for some reason, I was outside when Greg pulled into the parking lot. And Greg hadn't even left his car. He had just pulled into the lot, and he rolls down his window, and he says, "Fran, J.J. Watt was dominant against the Washington Redskins this week. Make sure you go watch it." And this was, obviously we were getting ready for Indianapolis. I wasn't going to be watching that tape for a week. But before you even got out of the car, those were the words that came out of your mouth.
That's right. And that may have been one of the best games. You know, I've been doing this a long time, so I'm always leery of saying the best. But just that game, he was unbelievable. And he actually does some things that would never be coached. And he's able to do them because he's such a great athlete. Like on zone runs away from him, he actually will go outside an offensive lineman away from flow, and he's still quick enough to make the play in the backfield. And I actually met him at a Super Bowl when we were doing Radio Row. We actually were doing the same show, and I asked him about that, and he turned to me and he said, "You're right. How do you know that I'm not supposed to do that?" And he said, "Yeah, I do it because I can."
Right.
And I'm sure the coaches don't say don't do that, because when you keep tackling the back in the backfield for a 3-yard loss, it's okay.
Exactly right. So, you know, obviously they've had some issues, you know, protecting the quarterback at Washington. Tyler Palumbus has struggled a little bit.
And that's a big concern in this game.
No question.
Because Cousins is a spot quarterback. You know, you want him off his spot. He's a timing rhythm guy. I think you're going to see a good amount of pressure from Bill Davis. And I think you're going to see up the middle pressure, which is really the focus against Andrew Luck as well.
Yep.
And he's far more mobile than Kirk Cousins. But I think the focus of the pressure schemes, and no one does the same thing 2 weeks in a row, so Bill Davis will have different concepts this week, but the same
idea.
Function, same yep. idea. But I think it'll be up the middle pressure.
Yeah, I mean, just watching this team, obviously, I was surprised. I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was surprised. I kind of expected this offense to look a lot different than what it was last year, and obviously, they took the read option element out of it for the most part. But really, I mean, this run game is focused on the outside zone. This is a zone stretch team still, predominantly.
I think they stayed with it because Morris is good at it.
Yeah.
I think that you'll see the tight end get. I don't know if Jordan Reed is he supposed to play this week.
I think it's still up in the air.
Okay. I mean, I think though that when he's healthy, you'll see him be a big factor because I don't know how many people are familiar with the Cincinnati Bengals offense where Jay Gruden was before, but you'll see a lot of elements of that.
Were they a zone stretch team there, or was he more power? Or?
They did both, but okay. I think – now, I've always felt that Morris could run power. He's a downhill runner.
Right.
But obviously under Shanahan, you know, it was the zone stretch, and he was very good at it.
Yeah, no question about it. And one of the things that, you know, the good coaches do, they pair their – biggest run play with one of their better pass plays.
Oh,
and one of the things they like to do is they run boot action off that outside zone stretch, and that was really one of their plays, really the only play they got any kind of rhythm against Houston, and they did it a couple times against Jacksonville as well with success.
Yeah, and I think that the play action pass game suits Kirk Cousins, and I think you'll look to do that. And that's one reason I think that this is where tendency – see, on both sides of the ball – play calling is about probability and tendency. It's not about certainty because you can't ever be certain, but it's about probability and tendency. And I think there'll be times where Bill Davis will have a sense that this may be a shot play off play action, and that's when you might see him attack with blitz because when the quarterback turns his back to the defense and then turns around, the last thing he wants to see is the opposing color jersey right in front of him. And so I think you're going to see a lot of inside pressure in this game.
Well, while we're talking about inside pressure, Jim Haslett, obviously a big pressure scheme. What have you seen from them? And obviously against the Eagles last year, one of the things I noticed just going back and watching them play last year, I guess I may have forgotten about it. A lot of things have happened over the last 10, 12 months.
Right, right.
But really, they played mostly, really majority, 95% in that percentile, nickel defense. They rarely played any base defense.
I don't remember them in the Week 11 game anyway blitzing much at all.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting to see the difference between how he was against every other team and then what he saw against the Eagles.
Well, and it'll be fascinating because now, you know, teams have had the offseason. It's a division rival. So, will Haslett, obviously, you know the Eagles will play fast. That's what they're going to do, okay? So, the question becomes, if you know that, how difficult is it to get lined up? Because you have to get lined up first and foremost, which sounds easy, but it's not. And then can you bring pressure when you do get lined up? Will he attempt to bring some pressure? I think when you watch Nick Foles through two games, if you're being honest and fair, you'd say he's been up and down. And I think he looks a little susceptible to pressure. And I think that's the way the Redskins coaching staff will see it. They'll feel that if we can get people around him, he won't be a real comfortable player. And don't you think, based on the first two games, that's a fair analysis?
Yeah, that's fair.
So I think that the question then becomes, will they try to do that? Or does the speed tempo force you just to line up and play without really putting much pressure on Nick Foles?
I mean, that's going to be really one of the intriguing matchups. And again, we talked about it last week, seeing how Foles responds. It wasn't the best game in the world against Monday night against Indianapolis either. So really just want to continue to see that progression and see if he can take the next step and kind of get this offense back on track. We say that as if they're not 2-0 leading the NFL
right.
in points and
but
yards. But
Look, you and I both know that this offense, it did not have a sustaining feel on Monday night.
Right.
And that's what this offense ultimately is. I mean, this is not truly a big play offense. And And right now, with the receivers, you know, with Cooper's not, I know he caught a lot of touchdowns last year, but he's not truly a burner. Macklin's still working his way back and getting a feel for this. You know, you can study the offense on the practice field and in the classroom, but until you're playing in it, you don't have a true feel for it. So he's really, he's in his third game coming up. So this offense, they're still trying to figure a lot of that stuff out. And, you know, I think that the speed is such an important part of this, because it's clear to me when you get to the second half of these games that the Eagles are wearing down opponents. And but the bottom line is, it's a sustaining offense at its core. It's not a true let's throw it down the field offense. And against Indianapolis, they had a few big plays. That's why they won. And you want those. But they didn't really sustain. And I guarantee Chip Kelly is looking at that offensive performance and saying that's not exactly what we want.
No question about it. Greg, we could sit here and talk.
Yes, we can.
All night long. I'm going to have to cut it short. I have one last thing. Before I had the opportunity to talk with Josh Norris, Roto World, NBC Sports earlier on. We talked pass rushers. What is it that you look for when you're looking at these college pass rushers and you're projecting them for the NFL draft?
Well, there's a couple of things, and it depends, obviously, on the body type of the player. I mean, if you're talking about a 275-pound guy, you might be looking for different things than if you're looking, you know, at a 230 or 235-pound guy. Ultimately, what I'd like to be able to see in a lighter guy is I'd like to see the ability to get to the edge and bend the edge, as we say, get low so we can get his shoulder and his body past an offensive tackle. Because if you can't get low, you end up just being pushed past the quarterback. And I'm not sure that's something you can teach. I think there are guys who are just naturally have that athleticism and flexibility. It's think of it this way. You almost separate the body at the waist. You almost have to see the upper part of the body and the lower part of the body as two separate things. And because if you can't do that as a pass rusher, if your body stays together, then you're a little stiff. And it's hard to get past tackles. Now, then there's the power part of it. And really what you like to see there is initial explosion off the ball, which doesn't necessarily require bend, you know, to go around an edge, but to be able to get right up inside of an offensive tackle quickly. Because if you can get inside of his pads quickly, even if he weighs 60 more pounds than you, you can move him. And that's critical if you're going to be a power rusher. And like I said, you don't have to weigh 290 pounds to be a power rusher. Then the other things you look for, which you don't see a ton in college, so you sort of have to try to extrapolate this, is there any kind of array of moves? Or does a guy just try to run around the corner? Or does a guy just run right into the offensive lineman every play and try to push him back? You try to see if a guy has any sense for counter moves, any sense of how to use his hands to set up an offensive tackle. So these are all things you look for. And one thing I've learned over the years, Fran, is you have to try to understand what's coachable, because these guys get 20 hours a week in college. They might not be coached on the finer points of pass rushing, you know, all the details, all the nuances. So one thing I learned from a lot of coaches at every position is, what can you coach? Because I've talked to coaches, and I'll finish up with this, where I'll watch a guy and think, oh boy, this guy's going to struggle. And a coach will say to me, I can correct that in 5 minutes. So you have to try to get a feel for what's coachable and what's not coachable.
And I think one of the guys that, you know, on that topic exactly, it's going to be a really interesting case study is going to be Vic Beasley out of Clemson. Undersized pass rusher. He's, you know, about 6'3", 230 pounds, maybe, wet, you know, soaking wet. So obviously an undersized guy, incredibly athletic, a fluid mover in space, really just a sudden, explosive, first-step quickness type of guy. Has all those athletic traits that you want, but really in terms of holding up at the point of attack, using his hands, able to shed blocks, maybe a step below of what you want, if not, and that might be being kind.
One final point, like you just said, we could talk all day. I happen to watch the Chiefs defense today.
Okay.
And Dee Ford.
Right. Guy, you know, felt okay. The same way about, yep.
Auburn, drafted 22nd, I believe, or 23rd by the Chiefs.
Yep.
To be an outside linebacker, not a D end. I saw a couple. He hasn't played a lot yet this year, maybe 10 snaps total, but there were a couple of running plays where he got moved so easily, and he stood straight up, which is a a common thing for college players. They stand straight up, and in the NFL, you could be the strongest guy in the world, and if you stand straight up, you get moved. And he's going to have to learn all this, and it takes time. And, you know, a lot of people felt Dee Ford was the number one pass rusher. I think he was after Anthony Barr, he was next, right?
It was, yeah, it would have been in the draft. Clowney, Barr. And
Clowney,
then,
Barr, right, Clowney,
actually,
obviously.
Yeah, that would have been it,
yeah.
Dee Ford.
So, exactly. I mean, a lot of people are looking at him as a potential big-time pass rusher, but you just mentioned about holding up, playing the point. I mean, he got moved so easily on a couple of running plays that I just said to myself, wow, he's got a lot of work to do.
And it's just going to be really interesting because, you know, I could think back to the spring, a guy like Anthony Barr, and I talked about this with Josh, a guy like Anthony Barr where has only been playing the position for a couple years, like Beasley, a bit, you know, on the leaner side, like Beasley, has all the athletic traits. It'll be interesting to see because Barr, by some, got killed for a lot of the, you know, maybe the perceived weaknesses at the point of attack. Can he use his hands? Is he tough? Those kind of questions. I'll be interested to see if Beasley gets those same questions. And really, I mean, just watching them, I feel like Barr was better at this point in his career.
Yeah, I thought Barr took a little bit of a bad rap. I mean, was he great at those things? No. But to me, I didn't look at him at UCLA and go, oh, my God, he's awful.
Yeah.
And I haven't studied Beasley yet, so I can't speak to him.
Yeah, it'll be a really interesting case study, like I said. So before we get to the end of that, let's go to this interview here with Josh Norris, Roto World. I caught up with him earlier today. Joining me now on the Eagle Eye in the Sky football podcast, one of my good friends in the business from Roto-World NBC Sports, draft analyst Josh Norris. Josh, thanks for joining me on the podcast, man. First time here.
First time here, first time caller, long time listener of the 2-week, 3-week podcast.
That's right. For the third week, I appreciate you coming on. So obviously the big topic of discussion this week, following you on Twitter and obviously following all your work on NBC Sports, talking pass rushers. And you released your top 10 list this week. What kind of kick us off here? What's this list looking like from the top up?
Well, if you followed me last year, you know I've had this infatuation with Sean Oakman. And I've listened to your show the first week with the high in Greg Cosell, the mighty Greg Cosell, I should say. And he mentioned Sean Oakman. And
he's
from the Pennsylvania area, went to Penn State, transferred after his first year, after redshirting, and so he didn't play football really for 2 years other than practicing. Last year he was even just a backup, a reserve. But whenever he entered the game, I mean, I'm telling you, from the first game I watched him, I thought he had first-round talent. What I love about him, 6'8", obviously 275, but he's got tremendous explosiveness, tremendous get-off, off the line of scrimmage, and he's also a former basketball recruit, but he uses his hands and his length to keep his opponent off balance, like smaller, more aggressive players. He doesn't have a lot of bend. I mean, he's not someone that has lateral agility or very fluid when forced to move laterally. But, man, in a straight line, when he has to bull rush you, he can blow you back. When he can run by you, he can absolutely do that. I mean, you say Oak Man, I say Oak Monster. And really, it's time to get on the hype train and get on Oak Mania, brother. That's what I'm saying.
You know, it's funny. Oakman was a guy, and you referenced it. He's from the Philly area, from Lansdowne. When I was at Temple University, as a member of their football program, we actually recruited Oakman before he declared, you know, that he was going to go to Penn State, and he was a basketball player. And obviously, right. At that point, I thought he was more athlete than football player. You know, he was a 4-star recruit, obviously was very highly regarded, but still hadn't put it together yet. So it's fun kind of seeing these guys develop when they get to college. Obviously, he's at his second stop there at Baylor. But really has come a long way since his days at high school. You saw guys, you know, that were a similar boat, you know, Muhammad Sanu, Logan Ryan, right. Ryan Nassib, a lot of these guys that came from down in this area, Sharif Floyd as well, actually, a Philly kid. You know, a lot of these guys have come out of this area and have turned into pretty decent pros. So I think this guy might be the next one in line.
So here, my thing is, I know everyone always wants to have some kind of comparison or prospect, but really there are prospects that come along that there's no real comparison for. And Oakman might be that type. I mean, I'm not sure exactly if there's someone of his frame that plays the same style of game that he does. I've seen some Calais Campbell comparisons. What's interesting, though, is obviously Oakman's a full-time starter this year, has had a blistering start to the season. I want to see him more work inside. I know he's doing that a little bit more this year. But if he can work inside, outside, I mean, he can play the 3, the 5, the 7, and the 9 if he has to. I mean, that's some pretty good versatility, some true versatility for a big-time prospect. Some people are saying first round for him. I think top 10 is a real possibility.
Very interesting. All right, well, the next guy on your list is a guy who I actually watched over the summer, a guy who really piqued my interest, came on the scene. I know our friend Dane Brugger is a big fan, Randy Gregory out of Nebraska.
Yeah, and he already had some slip-ups this year. I believe in the first game of the season, or following the first game of the season, he had to have arthroscopic knee surgery, and then came back 1 week later against Fresno State. And I just watched that Fresno State game this morning, and he looked back in true form. There was an opening play of the game when he was on defense. It was a quick screen, as Fresno State does, to the opposite side of the field, and he chased down the player for a tackle for loss. And then on the same series, he gets two quarterback hurries. I mean, he's so fluid and so twitchy that he's very tough for an offensive tackle to keep down in a one-on-one situation. To consistently block him in one-on-one situations is very tough because he's so fluid. I think I've seen a little bit more development with his hands and his technique, so he always has a leverage advantage or can win on a counter move. But he's another one that's a potential, honestly, top 10 pick. And this edge rushing class already at the top looks pretty good.
And he's another guy who's a former basketball recruit, 6'6", 245, that kind of movement skills. That, you know, those kind of guys don't grow on trees. So obviously, if he's another guy who comes out in this draft, like you said, it's looking pretty good right now.
Yeah, and both were redshirt sophomores last year that could have come out. Obviously, Gregory had a bit more playing time. And I believe he was a JUCO recruit, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. That's right.
Yeah, and moved up from last year. So, yeah, both could have entered last year. I expect both to enter this year. Yeah, and both are, like you said, big-time prospects.
So here's a guy, the number three on your list, that I was really interested to talk to you about. I've gotten a chance to watch him a little bit this fall, watched him last year, and that's Vic Beasley out of Clemson. Obviously, just unbelievable first-step quickness, very sudden mover, just really explosive first step. After that, though, there are some questions. What is your take on Beasley? Obviously, you like him, you know, a good amount. He's number three on your list here.
Well, I will try not to contradict myself with this evaluation. Let's put it that way. I'm all about finding where players win. And with Beasley, he obviously has tremendous explosiveness and a get-off off the snap. I mean, if he doesn't, he can beat a lot of heavy-footed offensive tackles with just that first step. And then he has closing speed and upfield speed as well, in my opinion. And then you have the fact that he flashes bend to turn the corner when he does gain that step. He can be a very effective rusher when at the end of the line and working against a tackle in one-on-one situations. And obviously, obvious passing situations. I've seen some hand use from him. I've seen him hold the edge, use that inside arm bar, and keep the outside shoulder free. I've seen him bull rush when asked to, when it seemed like it was predetermined that he was going to bull rush, and has done that very well. I have also seen people saying that he's having a down year, and I think that might be more of a production standpoint. But when I look at him this year, it seems like, and I know last year he tied the ACC record in sacks or something, or led the ACC in sacks last year, but he seems to be getting even more attention this year. Anytime he breaks that first level, the offensive line, he's either getting double teamed or chip blocked, and he just has nowhere to go. And it seems like Clemson is also closing him off in some situations. They're not putting him all the way on the edge. They're not putting him all the way so he can work out in some kind of space, leaving the edge blocker on an island. I think there are some similarities to Anthony Barr there. But, Fred, I'm kind of interested to hear what you're going to say.
Well, that's why I'm glad you brought it up. That's why you're a pro's pro, man. It was a great transition. Because there was a guy, obviously Anthony Barr last year, really kind of a polarizing prospect because obviously had all the physical tools, but a lot of people questioned things like his toughness, if he could hold up at the point of attack, what kind of run defender was he. And, when I see Beasley and I see Barr, and I was a big fan of Barr. I thought Barr showed the potential to excel in all those areas once he developed. Beasley, at this point, in my eyes, is further behind than Barr was. I'll be really interested to see how it plays out if those same kind of criticisms are giving towards Beasley that happened to Barr. And, obviously, people that liked Anthony Barr last year will like Vic Beasley this spring.
Yeah, and I was really critical of Anthony Barr. I don't want to say that I wasn't. I mean, I had him in like 15 to 20 area, I think. Not that that's a huge difference from where he went, like number nine, but I think that Anthony Barr and now Vic Beasley have traits that NFL teams covet, and they can use those traits to win in certain situations. I mean, even if Vic Beasley, I mean, I think you know what you're going to get from him in the fact that he can win with the speed rush on the edge at the very least, because he has bend and he has explosiveness. And I think that there have been flashes. I've seen some flashes of hand use, mainly in the running game. I would like to see more of him finding through counter moves, and that was a big issue I had with Anthony Barr. But with Anthony Barr, we had all these issues, and not issues really, but maybe just not across the board great traits. There were areas to work on. I think they're the same ones or some similar ones with Vic Beasley, but we've seen that the NFL covets those traits and those skills.
No question. It's going to be really interesting to see how his draft status evolves over the course of the next few months. Let's move on to number four here. You got Haole Kikaha from Washington. What was your take on him, watching him?
Big fan. Big fan of his game. And I think the biggest discussion this year will be that Washington is kind of moving from a quote-unquote 4-3 to a quote-unquote 3-4. So they're asking him to stand up a lot more, move a lot more. And really, when I watch it, I haven't watched every game. I think I've watched two of the three this year. There's no real difference in his role. I mean, I think we've had this discussion many times, Fran, but I think dropping in a 3-4 is a bit overrated, because on one side you're going to have a designated pass rusher. I mean, you guys see it all the time with Billy. Connor Barwin is kind of that move guy. He, unless you can correct me if I'm wrong, but he's the one that can be that versatile chess piece or matchup guy if you need him to be, not just a designated rusher. And if you put Kikaha standing up, he's going to be that designated rusher. His best skill is using his hands at the point of attack, and it's shedding blockers. He's got great strength. He was even used inside last year at times, which I really liked. He hasn't been doing that as much this year. But, yeah, and even when they're a nickel, I mean, he's basically a stand-up 4-3 defensive end. That's his role. That's his gap. So there's no real difference to me scheme-wise this year in his role. But, I mean, you're not going to ask a outside linebacker to really run with tight ends down the seam. I mean, if anything in coverage, he's just going to cover the curl-to-flat area. And if it's any more than that, coach should really just be fired, honestly.
Well, watching that kid as a junior, obviously a high-motor kid, and the medical is going to be a big thing with him, obviously, because he's missed some time with some injuries. Number five on your list, a guy who really stood out to me last year and one of the best defenses in college football, Shalik Calhoun, Bane, deemed him out Michigan State. What's your take on Shalik Calhoun?
Well, I look back to his game against Jake Fisher at Oregon. I thought Fisher did a really good job with it. I'm a big fan of Jake Fisher. He was the right tackle at Oregon last year, and then this year he's been having to play at left tackle, and I guess he's injured now anyways. But Calhoun, yeah, big, strong guy who can play in a straight line. I need to watch more in terms of if he can win in a variety of different ways. But from that baseline trait and that baseline skill, I think he has a lot of value.
So that's your top five. Let's take a look here at your bottom five, and I'll just kind of breeze through the names, and we'll just kind of touch on these guys real quickly. Number six, you've got Dante Fowler out of Florida, obviously a versatile guy, plays along the line there. Number seven, a personal favorite, UCLA's Oumagbe Odigizua. Sorry about that. He's a guy who I've watched for the last couple of years. Obviously, hip injuries have hurt him. It'll be interesting to see how his status kind of evolves here over the next few months. C.J. Johnson out of Auburn, a guy I have not personally watched, but
Ole Miss.
Yep, there we go. Ole Miss, sorry. So you've obviously got a beat on him. Number nine, Marcus Golden out of Mizzou, and number 10, Obum Gwachum out of Oregon State. What do you got on these four five guys?
Well, first, let's go with Fowler, and then I'll go with the last one. Fowler is someone who has dropped 20 pounds since his time at Florida. I guess previously had kind of been attached to that defensive end role. This year he's moving around a lot more. He's not only lining up in the three-point stance, but also two-point stance at the end of the line. And then even they're moving him inside and letting him blitz from the A or B gaps at times. He's not like overly twitchy or overly fluid or overly athletic. I think he has just enough to be successful in those areas. But he's got great technique. I mean, once again, I know I keep talking about hand use and length, but to me, it really does separate collegiate prospects at different levels of the field or at different levels of the rankings. Fowler really liked him. Someone even compared him to kind of a smaller, shorter version of Chandler Jones. I like that quite a bit. Chandler Jones is someone who's made me look back at my evaluations and really reevaluate them a little bit and what to prioritize. And so I'm a big fan of Fowler. Once again, I think he's just athletic enough to make offensive tackles concerned about inside and outside moves. And then when you're concerned about those inside and outside moves, he will attack you straight to your chest with hand use. And then the last one is the guy from Oregon State. I think he's a redshirt senior. Was a wide receiver before the season, a slot wide receiver at 6'3 or 6'4. He is now moved into a defensive end role, just super athletic, has super tremendous amount of upside, I guess I should say. I need to watch a lot more of him, but really there's not enough of him. I just thought, Fran, that, hey, if I like him how he is now, he can only go up. He can only improve because he's already shown a lot to me. So I want to get in that train early.
And obviously, any guy that's going to have that kind of length and that kind of athleticism as a former wide receiver is going to get some looks. So a guy that both of us will definitely be watching as the draft process unfolds.
Absolutely.
All right, Josh. Well, I appreciate you joining me for the podcast. We'll have to have you back soon, all right?
Absolutely, friend. Have a good one.
All right, Josh. Thanks. All right, that's going to do it here for the Eagle Eye in the Sky Football Podcast. I'm your host, Fran Duffy. We'll be back here next week with Greg Cosell. We're going to break down the matchup against the Washington Redskins, take a look at Week 4, talk football, do what we do every single week. Thanks for joining. We'll see you next week.